This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The events in Egypt were a catalyst throughout the Middle East for the yearnings for democracy and working class empowerment, and as well the aspirations and activism of the Egyptians has given inspiration to us here in the face of a full court press against the working class.
The report details the continuing conflict between the newly formed independent unions and the state unions. It provides a fascinating history of unions in Egypt, culminating in the emergence of a free trade union movement independent of the state, with demands for dissolution of the state unions, higher wages, and renationalization of substantial parts of previously privatized industries.
Now, Hossam El-Hamalawi, directly from Cairo, activist, historian, writer, blogger, as we talk to him fresh from a May Day protest. Happy May Day, brother.
Happy May Day to you.
Well, first of all, we have to find out what happened on May Day in, was it Tahrir Square? Is that where people convened?
Exactly. The focus of the celebrations were Tahrir Square, where independent trade union activists, in addition to left-wing groups, were mobilizing for protests, in addition to celebrations. However, simultaneously, the state-backed General Federation of Trade Unions, this notorious organization which labor activists are calling for its dissolution, had held also a parallel celebration in one of the military production centers, and it was attended by figures from the military junta that is ruling Egypt now.
Can you tell us more about the conflicts between the independent unions and the so-called official unions?
Since 1957, the Nasserite regime had established the so-called General Federation of Trade Unions, which is mistakenly referred to as a labor union because it's not. It's a government-controlled entity which acts as the arm of the state when it comes to mobilizing the working class, very similar to the organizations that existed in the former Soviet Union or the former Eastern Bloc, where government bureaucrats, security-friendly workers, occupy the positions within that federation. And this federation never endorsed a strike, always sabotaged strikes, used to coerce workers into going out to the streets in order to cheer Mubarak whenever he visited any town, those carnivals of hypocrisy. In addition, and more importantly, the head of the federation itself is currently in jail after the revolution because of his involvement in organizing attacks by thugs against the protesters in Tahrir during the uprising. So it was not a surprise in the past that every single strike that happened in Egypt usually ended up with the workers trying to impeach or even assaulting their local union officials. But at the same time, there were attempts by sincere activists and strike leaders in different sectors in Egypt to establish independent unions, which were almost impossible in the past. But this started to change with the current strike wave that has been exploding in this country since 2006. And there were already, before the January Revolution, at least three independent unions. Now, today, we're talking about at least a dozen, and almost every week, we get a new declaration of a new independent union. These independent trade unionists were, in the past, intimidated by the security services, sometimes kidnapped, sometimes tortured, sometimes just threatened. They were fired from their jobs. They were subject to administrative crackdowns in the past. But this is changing. Since the role of the working class in the current revolt has been central to bringing down Mubarak, and even after our middle class has lost steam when it comes to mobilization, with Mubarak stepping down, the working class only escalated their militancy. And they are basically finishing up the job, which is our revolution. That's hardly unfinished. Maybe we got rid of Mubarak, but the regime is still there. In every single factory, there is a mini Mubarak. In every single bank, there is a mini Mubarak. In every single workplace, in every single institution, there is a mini Mubarak. And while the middle class activists have been calling on the people to suspend protests and give the transitional cabinet a chance to bring about the desired change, the workers are not listening to this, and they are taking matters into their own hands, rightly so, and they are continuing with their strikes against corruption, demanding the impeachment of all figures affiliated with the old regime, in addition to improving their work conditions, which have been in such a draconian state, sometimes even unmatched in other places. So the tension continues till today between the independent and the state-backed unions. We have all expected, many of us, especially those on the left, that the military junta would respond to the protesters' demands during the revolution and would dissolve the state-backed General Federation of Trade Unions. But just as with many other demands that the protesters have put forward during the uprising, the military junta has actually betrayed us, and they have not listened, neither have they fulfilled our demands. Hence, the mobilization continues. We are working on building this independent federation of trade unions. We are working on establishing political parties for the working class, although the military junta also legislated against the formation of religious and or labor parties. And we're continuing with that, hoping that the working class would provide leadership for the rest of the population when it comes to this political transition process.
I want to also go back to a prior period and understand more about the trade union movement during, for example, the period of Nasser and in the 60s, because I feel that it is rather strategic for people here who have either little information or sometimes are somewhat chauvinistic to understand the sophistication and organization that actually did take place amongst the working class. So if you could give us a capsule, a history, which will help inform our understanding of certainly the activities to form what appears to be a new workers' party.
The high tide of Egyptian trade unionism were in the 1920s with the formation of the Egyptian Communist Party and its central role in founding trade unions. And the second high tide, I would say, in the 1940s, following before, during, and after the Second World War, where also the Egyptian left was central to the unionization fight among workers in the textile sector and elsewhere. If you read the memoirs of one of the Egyptian communist leaders in that period of time, his name is Henri Coriel, he wrote about the 1946 strikes, for example, in Egypt, saying, "We suddenly found all the masses behind us, but we didn't know where to lead them." It's just an anecdote of how lively the labor movement scene was at the time. When Nasser carried out his coup together with the free officers in 1952, that was actually a setback for the labor movement, not an advancement. Many people, including myself, believe that if this coup had not happened, maybe we would have gotten a real revolution, since the level of social struggle at the time was just escalating day by day. You had labor strikes taking place from 1946 onwards. You had mini peasant uprisings in several parts of the Nile Delta and in Upper Egypt against the landlords. You had the outbreak of the resistance, the armed resistance against the British occupation in the Suez Canal cities. You had continuous student protests in Cairo University, which was the main and more or less, I mean, it wasn't the only university, but the main one at the time. The intervention of the military and its ousting of the unpopular king that we had was initially received positively by the Egyptian people. But over the following two decades, Nasser's populism was quite contradictory. On the one hand, he rhetorically preached socialism, equality, and justice. But in reality, he formed a new ruling elite in Egypt composed of military officers and their bureaucrat or and government bureaucrats, senior government bureaucrats around them, who ruled the state machine. And Nasser, in 1957, destroyed, actually, the trade union movement by nationalizing the unions, as we say it here in Egypt, and founding the General Federation of Trade Unions, which continues to live with us till today. But at the same time, there isn't a dictatorship that just rules with an iron fist. Any dictatorship, especially populist ones, they have to give reforms. And there were tons of reforms under Nasser when it came to job security, when it came to the housing sector, when it came to the living standards of the workers themselves, their access to education, their access to basic commodities in society that they were deprived from. And no one can deny that. But the Egyptian working class, whenever it moved independently from the regime at the time, it was crushed completely by the security services. This started to change a little bit by 1968. I know when the year 1968 is mentioned, usually everyone thinks of Paris, of the anti-Vietnam War movement, right, of the global uprising around the world. But guess what? The Arabs also had their own 1968 in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in elsewhere. The defeat of the Arab regime in front of Israel in 1967 was a further trigger to those protests that took to the streets in 1968, where student protesters were slamming their local regime, saying that you asked us to give up the freedom of speech and civil liberties in the name of fighting the enemy. Well, you fought the enemy and you lost. So we need democracy here. And maybe if our countries were democracies, maybe we could have been able to protect our countries and liberate Palestine from any occupation. This labor movement, it was a student movement, but actually workers joined them. And in the case of Egypt, it was the workers who first took to the streets in February 68, slamming Nasser for the mock trial he held for the Air Force generals who were blamed for the defeat in front of Israel. And from 1968 all the way till 1977, the level of social struggle in Egypt was going up day by day, whether it's on the factories or whether it's on university campuses. Till we got our uprising in 1977, which only lasted for 2 days in January, it was triggered, this uprising back then, by the government's decision to lift subsidies of basic commodities that are extremely essential for the Egyptian public in general. And this came after a few years where Sadat was reproaching the U.S. and reproaching Israel, and he was raising the expectations of the Egyptian people about the wealth to come and about the economic flourishment that's going to come. In case your listeners didn't know, it's Sadat's Egypt and Chile and Pinochet's Chile who were more or less the first pioneers of neoliberalism in the Third World. We started our neoliberal reforms in 1974, which of course had to be shelved away temporarily in 1977 following the uprising. Now, all across the following decades, the 1980s and the 1990s under Mubarak, the labor movement was not in a good shape either. Since the defeat in 1977, industrial struggle took a downturn, and with the very few sit-ins and labor protests that we witnessed in the 1980s and 90s, they were unfortunately put down by the security services using live ammunition. Most notoriously, the case of the Helwan steel mills in 1989, where one worker was shot dead during the 18-hour occupation, which took place. And the second example, most famous example, is the Kafr Dawar textile mill in 1994, where three people got killed by the security services during the peaceful sit-in they held. Simultaneously, as the labor movement was going through its downturn, in 1992, the Egyptian regime, together with the IMF and the World Bank, started implementing the so-called ERSAP program, the Economic Reforms and Structural Adjustment Program, which included one of the most aggressive neoliberal packages in the Third World at the time. Factories and businesses were privatized on a mass scale. Social spending was cut. Spending on education was cut. Many of the old social services that were presented by Nasser's welfare state were cut, which is a very similar story to what happened also in Western Europe and even in the U.S. with the austerity measures that was sweeping the world at the time. And just to give you an idea of how much the working class was decimated by these reforms, by 1991-1992, the total population of workers involved in the textile sector amounted to roughly 500,000. This figure shrunk to only 250,000 workers 10 years later. At the same time, Egypt was going through a dirty war, Latin American style, but maybe with a lesser intensity than countries like Guatemala or Argentina, for example. But the same tactics were practiced by the Egyptian security services against the Islamist insurgents in 1992 onwards. And once you have a war on terror, this means that the government can get away with anything, even crushing peaceful dissent. But since 2000, especially with the outbreak of the Palestinian Intifada, street politics was revived. Maybe the labor movement was not part of the anti-war and the pro-Palestine protests initially, but they started to make an intervention later. And in December 2006, with the outbreak of the Mahalla strike, Mahalla is a textile mill located in the Nile Delta town of Mahalla, and it's considered the biggest textile mill in the Middle East, with 27,000 workers working in that factory. Now, this strike, which started on the hands of the women workers in the factory, lasted for 3 days. And after the Mahalla workers won, that's when we started talking about the winter of labor discontent. Every single textile factory in the Nile Delta and in Upper Egypt and in Alexandria went on strike, demanding similar demands to those won by Mahalla. And the militancy started spilling over to other sectors in the Egyptian working class, to the extent that the government was warning of the plague of strikes in Egypt. And these strikes were ultimately countered, or they were fought against, not only by the security services, but also by the state-backed unions. It was extremely surreal. If you have seen any pictures, you as a non-Egyptian would see pictures of, let's say, the strike leaders negotiating with the bosses. Because on the one hand, you will find the strike leaders sitting on one side of the table, while on the other side of the table, there would be the CEO, the state security officer, and the state-backed union official. Mm. I mean, everybody understood what state-backed unions were for. But it's only when the property tax collectors went on strike in 2007 for 3 months, during which tax collection on property dropped by 90%, and they held mass protests in downtown Cairo. After they won, they founded Egypt's first independent trade union since 1957. And to be exact, it was announced in December 2008. And since then, that's when you got by the domino effect. They became an inspiration for other sectors in the Egyptian working class and the civil servants to start also unionizing themselves. These attempts did not succeed except in three places before the revolution. But as the revolution broke out here in Egypt, the Independent Federation of Trade Unions was declared, its nucleus was declared on the 30th of January in Tahrir Square. And right now, any, let's say, like independent trade union activist who succeeds in pulling together a union in his workplace would go and join this federation. We're trying to build an independent federation now that can, number one, smash the state-backed federation. Number two is to lobby for the workers' demand, which were raised during the revolution and which the military junta seems not to care about. And number three, the trade unions are always the fighting school for the working class. That's where people get together, understand their power, realize how much they can bring about change if they act in a collective manner. So the trade union struggle, once again, I mean, to recap, although it was almost destroyed under the previous regimes, I am extremely optimistic about it now and about its prospects in the future.
Well, once you've finished organizing Egypt, we want to bring you and the Egyptians here to help us out because I haven't heard a clearer explanation of what's going on there and what we also need here. And the only thing I would like you to 1 minute and talk about renationalization of the industries.
After the aggressive neoliberal campaign, which was launched by the government from 1992 onwards, the textile sector was the most hard hit by the privatization scheme. And, I mean, the privatization in general here, I mean, every day, sir, we would hear and learn more information about how corrupt those deals were. Since the regime is like crumbling at the moment. What used to happen is the following, that some foreign investor or local investor would come and would negotiate a totally corrupt deal with the local officials in Egypt to sell him or her or to sell their company some state-owned textile mill, which, I mean, textile mills in Egypt are quite huge. It's a huge compound. And land in Egypt, real estate is very expensive. And especially in the Nile Delta, it's even more expensive than Cairo. So the tactic that all investors employed more or less was get the company for a very cheap price and then sabotage it. Sabotage it meaning, like, do not renew the old machinery. Do not do maintenance. Keep sacking the workers. Keep disrupting the production. Until basically you get rid of your labor force and then you demolish the factory and you sell it as real estate to do whatever business on it. But although the workers in the 1990s were totally demoralized and many of them willingly accepted the early buyouts that were offered by businessmen and by the government at the time in order to leave their jobs, but the mood today is different. It's a fighting mood. So you have in several of those companies, the workers are putting forward demands to renationalize those firms and to take them back to the public sector. And in some cases, workers have taken over those firms and self-managed them temporarily. The new so-called revolutionary cabinet of Dr. Issam Sharaf has reiterated more than once, has repeated always, that they will not renationalize those privatized firms because that will scare away any potential investors in the future. And they also gave very vague statements about privatization, whether it will continue or not. But at the same time, facts speak for themselves. Up until now, they have not been renationalized. Secondly, our ministers are in touch with the IMF over new loans with new packages from them, which I find totally ludicrous. because it's the IMF and the World Bank and those neoliberal policies which got us where we are today. And we are not unique. Look at Indonesia, look at the other third world countries who implemented those neoliberal reforms and went down the drain. And now they want to repeat them again. But at the same time, the workers are vigilant. I have my complete confidence and my complete faith goes to the Egyptian working class that they know what's right and what's wrong. And they will not trust anyone until they see their actions on the ground. So up until now, the workers are vigilant. They are still in their own factories. They are still organizing. There are still strikes and protests happening as I'm talking to you. And the campaign will continue until not just to renationalize those factories, but for the workers to seize control of them too.
Well, that's the note that we're going to have to end this extremely exciting and informative May Day section directly from Cairo. Your analysis is so crisp and important and informative. I know that you're a blogger, you're a photographer, but I prefer at this moment to call you, you're a historian, you're an educator. I really thank you for informing us and spending the time with us on this May Day, my brother. And I hope we can have you on many more times to follow the progress and development of our sisters and brothers in Egypt.
I will be more than honored, and thanks a lot for your support and for your help in spreading the word about the Egyptian working class.
Indeed. Hassam El-Hamalawi, it has been entirely our inspiration and pleasure. We'll have you back many times, and we'll follow the progress, and as Ken said, use your activities as an inspiration to mobilize the working class here as well.
I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.